This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest neurologist, Frances Jensen, says don't think of your teenage children as some alien species, even though they act nothing like the sweet and agreeable 10-year-old who used to live under your roof. She says that teens are often misunderstood, existing in that altered universe between childhood and adulthood. A clue to understanding why they take risks, don't understand consequences, are moody, defiant, stay up late on a school night, gets more clear when you look at the wiring and architecture of their brains. They are different from adult brains. Frances Jensen has done that as a researcher, and she's also raised two teenage boys, so she has some hands-on experiences. She's also the co-author of a new book called The Teenage Brain, a neuroscientist's survival guide to raising adolescents and young adults. She's a professor and chair of the neurology department at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, has done research on the development from the neonatal period through adulthood. And Frances Jensen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So if we could use time-lapse photography and take a teenage brain and start the photographs, let's say when they're 12 or 13 years old, starting puberty, into, let's say, mid-20s, what changes would we see over that time period?
That is a great question. And indeed, that study has actually almost been done.
Really?
Thanks to advanced imaging, we can look at brain connectivity using something called functional MRI and diffusion tensor imaging to look at the connections from parts of the brain from one side to the other. And actually, a group from NIH has done this. They took kids and checked and did these functional MRIs every year from the age of like 5 to 20. And you see this. And what do we see changing? Well, first of all, the brain connects itself over time from the back to the front. And the last place to fully connect with high-speed connections that are insulated, just like a phone wire, but it's an insulation called myelin, which is a natural substance, that process takes 2.5 decades to complete. So the last place to connect up fully for fast split-second connectivity is the frontal lobe. So, you know, you're going to smile because what does the frontal lobe do? It's insight, judgment, executive function, and that's just not done yet with teenagers.
Well, that's so interesting to think that it develops from back to front. I mean, is there an evolutionary reason for that?
Yeah, actually, basic neuroscience has shown that all nervous systems across all species develop from the inside out and from the back to the front. That's the way embryos form.
So how does that then help us understand just teenagers? If that's their brain, what does that tell us about them?
Yeah, so that's one big – there's a second part, which I'll get to in a minute. But, yes, the fact that they're not connecting their frontal lobes up, the different regions of your brain subserve lots of different functions, right? Your emotional centers are actually back a ways, sort of behind your ears, sort of where our earphones are right now. So they're behind. They actually get connected up a little sooner than your frontal lobes. So what happens is teenagers are very prone to the influences of their emotional systems, their limbic systems, without the regulation of the frontal lobe. But the frontal lobe is saying, wait, don't control this impulse. Mm-hmm. This is not a good idea. There's a cause and there's an effect. You know, put the two together, reason. And they can reason. It's not like teenagers don't have a frontal lobe. It's not empty up there. But it is not connected with high-speed connections yet. So when they're in a split second under a lot of pressure, they won't necessarily use the same judgment that we enjoy as adults.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, but also going back to your book, you write about an oversupply of neurons and then, I guess, undersupply of white matter. Translate what you mean by that for us.
Yes. So that was what I just alluded to. That's the second part of the story of the big two differences of the teenage brain, to kind of sum it up. So, as I said, the brain's the last organ in the body to mature. It takes till your mid-20s. And this connection from region to region is a big part of that story. And that connection, we call it white matter. You have gray matter, where all the neurons are, which is sort of the outside mantle of your brain underneath your skull. But underneath that, those brain cells are sending processes from one side of the brain to the other, down to the spinal cord. They're insulated with something called myelin, which looks white. That's why we call it white matter. The development of this white matter, this connection structure, is the thing that takes a very long time. But the gray matter, which has all the neurons in, is a very different story. There, the teenagers actually have a significant advantage over adults. They have more brain cells and actually more synapses, which are where two brain cells talk to each other. They connect by a synapse, and they have more of those. Interestingly, when we learn, what we do is we repeatedly use a circuit of a couple of brain cells talking to each other via a synapse. And the more you use it, the bigger the synapse grows. So now that synapse is stronger, and that's what we call memory. So actually, teenagers have more synapses. They have more machinery to build the synapse so that they can learn things much more easily. They don't have to practice 25 times like an adult. They can get their learning in two or three times. Children are even better. So the synapse is, you know, we call it synaptic plasticity. It's coming down from childhood, but the adolescents definitely have more of it than adults.
So they're smarter than we are?
They can memorize things better, right. And you will notice that if you've ever gotten into a sort of a memory game with your teenager.
Indeed, I have. When they say, don't you remember when you said X, Y, and Z?
Right.
And of course you can't. It's so easy to think about teenagers and all the, you know, the challenging and risky things they do. But there are so many wonderful things about teenagers as well. Does the brain help us understand that as well?
Yes.
I'm thinking in terms of creativity, for instance.
Exactly. So a lot of this relates to this term I just used, synaptic plasticity, which means that your brain connections, your synapses, are plastic. They're molded by experience. It's the more you use them, the greater and bigger they get, more of your brain area that is given over to a certain task or a data set is built larger if you use it. So that's actually what's happening. Teenagers actually can learn faster, harder, stronger, longer than adults. Did you know that your IQ can change in your teenage years?
Well, I didn't know until I read your book, but yes.
And that is an example of it's a golden age. It's a time that kids can really use to scaffold their brain. And I think one of the things I tried to point out in the book and in whenever I'm talking about this topic is that I think we should think about this as a real window of opportunity for curriculum development in the educational, social development. They can change. And you know what? If you start your teens one way, it doesn't mean you have to end that way. And I think that goes for whether you're going to be a scholar or not, or whether you're going to be a delinquent, a juvenile delinquent or not. You could change yourself. And that's something that I think teenagers have to have confidence and know about. It's a gift.
Is there a difference between a teenager's brain if they're male or female? Are there differences at all based on sex and gender?
Yes. So, well, one of my colleagues, Raquel Gurr, over at the University of Pennsylvania, she's been looking at the differences between male and female brains and how their white matter connects. How do you connect back to front, side to side? And she's actually found there are gender differences between adult men and women, that our brains have a different patterns of connectivity. Actually, men are more back to, go from within a hemisphere, going back in front, and women tend to have more connections going from side to side, sort of more lateral thinking. But what we find is that this process of development that I said goes from, all the way through infancy to mid-20s, males are about 2 years behind females in this. So I think that one of the times when this becomes most obvious, and obviously there are individual differences. You can have a boy that's ahead and a girl that's behind, et cetera, is sort of at the 13, 14, 15 window. Mm. If you think back, and I'm sure parents listening today will think about the difference between a girl who's writing down all her homework, she has little notepads and very organized, or organizing all the social events, but the boy who you are banging on the door to get into the closed school to ask the janitor if you could please get to his locker to get the textbook for the exam that's the next morning because they just didn't think about it.
If we're raising teenagers, is it important to tell them about their brain? I mean, to say, this is why you might be doing something like this. This is why you're smoking cigarettes. This is why you're staying up till 2 a.m. know that you have to get up at 7:30 to go to school.
This is a huge point. You have to realize that this is very new research. So research on the early development and on the aging brain is much further along than research on the teen brain. Most of the teen brain research is just about 10 years old, 10 to 15 years old. So actually, this is the first generation of teenagers that have had the access to the neurobiology, the knowledge of what their brain state is right now. And yes, I think that it should be taught to them in schools. I think they should be made aware that they are more vulnerable to risk-taking. We'll talk about some other vulnerabilities too, but that they also have this hidden strength that I think hasn't been really appreciated by society at large, that this is sort of a time that they can really scaffold their brain and, you know, be very mindful. They have one brain. It's not getting any bigger, and they're not really building any new brain cells. They're really having to work with what they make during this late teen, early adult period. It's scaffolding it for the future. What they lay down there will allow them to do more learning in certain areas in later life. And they can learn faster, so they can acquire more knowledge, like a language, now versus an adult.
I mean, is that what you're saying, which is have as many experiences as you possibly can, or focus in on something and learn to do it really well?
Well, I mean, we can't overdo, you know, their brains would probably explode if you tried to give them everything.
Sure.
But we do have to realize their capacity is probably greater than the typical adult for taking in new information. And I am a strong believer that we should be probably thinking about how do we work on correcting strengths or correcting weaknesses, or at least addressing weaknesses if somebody has a learning style difference, and then working on strengths, that's talent, a particular instinctual advantage that a given person has. This is a time to really build on that. So I think that, really our education system tends to pay a lot of attention to the people who are rightfully needing this in sort of the bottom 20% of the class. But I think that with today's information technology, we should be at least sort of doing screens on everybody. Everybody's got strengths and weaknesses. There's not a single perfect person on this planet, and it would be a good time to really understand yourself and work a little harder on that.
You mentioned risk-taking, and I think we can, if we remember our own adolescence or no adolescence, there is a time when many of them do take risks. Is it about novelty? I mean, is it about seeking something new? And it's not just a thrill, but experiencing something that they've never experienced before.
Yeah, so this particular stage in life is one where there's a lot of self-exploration, trying to understand one's identity, and a lot of novelty-seeking behavior, which we all have, but we also couple that with impulse control as adults. And by not having that frontal lobe really there to say, don't take this risk, it's clear that this has got to be one of the major explanations for why teenagers are such risk takers. Now, it's not like this is big news. Car insurance companies have known this, and car rental companies have known this for ages. We know that they're risk takers, but I think by telling them explicitly that you have this weakness, you think you're immortal. Everybody does in that window. But let's listen to some stories where people just like you had something happen because they didn't think through it. And sort of maybe being more explicit with reminding them of explicitly situations that can be harmful to them or where they're most tempted.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Frances Jensen. She is a neurologist, a neuroscientist, also co-author of this book we're talking about called The Teenage Brain. And it's subtitled A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. We've been talking about the evolution, the development of the teenage brain, and of course, why they behave the way they do. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Frances Jensen. She's a professor chair of the neurology department at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, co-author of this new book called The Teenage Brain. And do you ever wonder why your teenager acts the way they do? Well, perhaps the brain and their brain can help explain what is going on. And again, to join the conversation, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to talk about addiction, something that you write about in the book, and why young people seem to be vulnerable to overdoing it when it comes to drinking or drugs or even smoking cigarettes. Is there something about the teenage brain that can explain that to us?
Yes, and this is something I think is really good information for teenagers to actually have too, as well as young adults. College students still fit into this window, of course. So remember when I said the teen brain is a learning brain? It's much more able to learn. It has better synaptic plasticity. It can build synapses much more easily to learn a fact or a skill than an adult. Well, it turns out that addiction is actually a form of learning. It uses the same mechanism. So instead of a fact or a practice, it's a drug that you're repeatedly, you know, stimulating yourself with. And just like a fact, you learn, your pathway gets stronger and stronger, your reward pathway gets stronger and stronger in your reward circuits in your brain. And unfortunately, it becomes hardwired much faster. Just like a fact that is memorized can be hardwired in a brain in a teenager much faster, so can a bad thing like addiction. So they get addicted harder, stronger, longer, faster than an adult. And this is a huge vulnerability because, of course, they're more taking risks. And sure. Then, of course, with the internet and social networking, some of these things come so easily to them that they really are – it's just like a perfect storm.
If that's true, and I don't doubt it, then how does someone intervene? If you have a teenager who smokes cigarettes – I mean, I smoke cigarettes as a teenager or is abusing drugs or alcohol as a parent or an adult, how do you intervene under those circumstances?
I think you have to do a lot of explaining and a lot of vigilance. It is definitely something to try to avoid. Try to avoid seeing your child get addicted. That is as a teenager, it is a much more serious illness than it will be, than it would even be in an adult. Addiction is terrible at all windows. But because it happens in the teenage brain, it actually changes the way the brain continues to develop.
Wow.
And therefore, they will be addicted lifelong, and it's so much harder for them to quit than an adult. So this is one of many things about substances of abuse. The potential to be addicted is one thing, but actually the effect of these substances on the brain at that moment in time is usually stronger and more severe than in an adult, because most of these drugs and actually some of the other rewarding experiences that can also you can get addicted to actually work by functioning on synapses, you know, and which they have more of. So they are actually more susceptible to longer lasting effects of binge drinking, cannabis, other drugs like ecstasy, angel dust. All these things tend to, when they've been looked at in studies, in published studies, and we put these things in the book. Like a lot of the book has like real data in it. This would be an area where I put real data in. So you can show it to a teenager. Literally show it to a teenager.
I was thinking about, I don't know if it still exists now, there was a campaign, this is your brain on drugs.
The fried eggs.
I'm thinking of the fried eggs, as a matter of fact. I mean, is that an effect, as much as you know about teenagers and their brains, is that an effective message, do you think? Was that an effective message?
I don't know. It was in the 1970s.
It was.
And I think the problem is that it sounded like, we adults are telling you this just because we're telling you this. There was no facts to back it up. There was no offering of anything logical or anything, any details behind that statement. So I think, you know, many people in the 70s or 80s, whenever that ad was, just laughed at it, right? So one of the things, again, about what we did in this book and what I've done in these Teen Brain 101 talks that I've done is I give real data because – you know what? Teenagers, this generation of young people, teenagers and young adults, are very fact-based. They respect facts. They're an information age generation. Data is everything. And they are going to respond to data, the hope is, to a greater extent than just a parent saying, because I told you so.
Right. Or this ad told you so. As we know, marijuana is becoming more available. I mean, there's states where obviously there's medical marijuana, a couple of states where there's now recreational marijuana. Does that concern you when it comes to teenagers?
It does very much, actually. I know it, you know, even in states where it's been legalized, it's not legal for somebody 18 to use the drug, but it'll be around and it'll be accessible. The problem is that actually in through your early 20s, cannabis has a long-lasting effect on your brain development. First of all, it has a long-lasting effect in the moment. Instead of people getting high and then it wears off within hours, in the teen brain, it can be there for days. And remember I told you about learning? They're like learning brains, the synaptic plasticity. It blocks that process. So their learning is impaired for days after getting high. Not so much as an adult.
Permanently or temporarily?
Well, temporarily in that case. But chronic pot smoking, day after day, through between 13 and 17, again, this is what I put in the book, a study, shown that it can drop your IQ in what we call a dose-dependent fashion. So the more you smoke, the further your IQ drops. And remember I said that there's so much synaptic plasticity at this wonderful age in development that unfortunately you can tune it up, you can tune your IQ up, or you can actually have negative things make it go down. You're still very malleable. So it doesn't only mean that you can, you know, it only goes one way. So unfortunately, cannabis, there's actually a fair amount of information now showing that it does decrease IQ in a dose-dependent way permanently. You can't get that back. You cannot get that back.
Would you, I mean, not that you could do this, but would you like the laws then to make some of this stuff available when someone is 25? The book is about the fact that the brain doesn't stop developing at age 18 or 19. It really develops into the early 20s.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't think the story's over yet with cannabis. I think there was just recently a paper showing that there was some negative effects on the brain of adults as well. So I think we have to be – this is a whole new world of people looking at it in this sort of more clinical way, which is a good thing because we need to do that. We need to understand it better. But definitely – and that's also for the college kids. You know, there they are. They're in college to learn, right? And they're actually doing so many – activities that actually impair that one thing that they actually have a gift for. And getting high frequently is one of those things that's going to impair their long-term performance.
What about alcohol? And I mean, there's a lot of binge drinking when it comes to college, for instance.
Yes. So the deal with alcohol is not too different. First of all, if you look in the moment, what is alcohol doing to the synapse? It is preventing that growth of the synapse to learn. It will prevent that set of, you know, molecular events. So once again, alcohol is going to affect learning and memory. We kind of know that, right?
Right.
It also makes you disinhibited. Well, let's just think about this. Teenagers have less inhibition to start with because their frontal lobes aren't on a split-second, you know, connection pattern with like adults. So they're going to get disinhibited even faster and possibly do even more risky things. So that's number two.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is that binge drinking, because they actually have more synapses around than the adult, binge drinking for a given amount of blood alcohol level that would make an adult intoxicated, you actually get brain cell death in the teenager with a binge drinking episode. So there is more harm done. And this actually is one of the myths, for instance, to debunk. One of the reasons for getting this information out is to debunk myths because people think, oh, they're resilient. They'll bounce back. You know, he had a bender. He'll sleep it off. We'll see him tomorrow morning. You know, no, they are actually suffering more damage. And that's a message that I think needs to be considered by young people.
Well, you know what, and I do want to get to callers, and I've got some comments here as well. You also, thinking of the brain and also potential harm to the brain, you have a whole section in here about concussions.
Right.
And young people playing sports. And as we know, I mean, we're worried about this when it comes to professional players. But obviously, concussions in young people can have a pretty serious effect.
Yeah. So first of all, it's this whole story about, you know, the whole situation with the teenage brain is not all gloom and doom. The main big thing to realize that this is a incredibly impressionable period of brain development where you can do amazingly wonderful things for your brain that you won't be able to do very easily later. It is very impressionable, but that means it's impressionable to good things. You can bump your IQ, you can learn skills, but it's also impressionable to bad things, which includes substances of abuse and also stress and also physical injury. So again, the pattern keeps repeating. Concussions actually cause more injury to the teen brain. That this has now been shown. And even since I wrote the book, there's been some studies to show academic performance takes a bigger hit in adolescents compared to children or adults with the same amount of concussion. Certainly repeated concussions are what we need to avoid. But it is becoming more obvious now that this brain, largely because, remember I said the white matter, it's not fully myelinated, so it's not strong enough. So what happens when the brain gets impacted, the brain kind of moves back and forth too much inside the skull, and you can get shearing injury and sort of bruising of the brain more in a teenager than an adult.
How do you look at this question about nature, nurture? I mean, we've been focusing on the brain, but obviously all teenagers, all people are different, growing up with different experiences. What is the synaptic connection there?
Well, this is this nature versus nurture. I mean, it was first studied, obviously, early in life. And right. That's where I think we've realized that, early enrichment can change the way your brain develops. And this is the period, we call it a critical period in early development where children can learn 2 and 3 languages flawlessly. But, the teenager is sort of a second critical period. It's a second golden moment where you're more mature, you've got more substantive sort of scaffolding there, but you can still learn faster and add more elements that will serve you for the rest of your life.
We all know teenagers who do take risks, do all the things that we associate with the stereotypes of teenagers, and we know teenagers who do none of that, who are highly responsible and, almost like the opposite of the more risk taker. Is the brain an explanation, or is it some other combination of factors?
Well, I have to say I'm a little biased, but I would say the brain is an explanation
here. Okay.
And I think that there's individual variation. Some, when I was saying earlier that boys are generally 2 years behind girls, there are boys that are ahead of most girls, some. It's individual. Everybody's on their own little journey through brain development. And in a way, going back to something else I said earlier, it would be wonderful if we could sort of capture that with a tool where we could, interview kids or have a survey or some sort of assessment tool where you kind of learn where you are in this journey so that you know how to use it. You know where you're more vulnerable, where you're less vulnerable, where you're stronger. It would be wonderful. And I think that day will come.
Well, I mean, the idea is that you literally would know what your brain was about, right?
Yeah.
What it looked like.
Yeah.
Where your strengths
You know
and
that with the rest
were.
Of your body.
What an interesting idea. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Our guest is Frances Jensen. She's a neuroscientist, a neurologist, professor, chair of the Department of Neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine, and that's at the University of Pennsylvania. She's been doing research and brain research from the neonatal period through adulthood. She's also the co-author of a book that we're talking about, and it's called The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. In fact, we have an email from Liz. She says, what does your guest think about the morality of prosecuting teenagers and young adults for crimes if their brains are still developing? Now, we do have a juvenile justice system, but as we know, more and more young people have been thrown into the adult population, mm-hmm. in part because of the heinousness of their crimes. But how do you wrestle with that?
Well, I was actually part of two amicus briefs to the Supreme Court several years ago around the issue of when heinous crimes are committed by somebody under the age of 18, 17 and under, that they would have no opportunity for parole ever. So life without parole, period. And we argued that this is a decision that needs to be made not as a blanket statement but on an individual basis, that this same synaptic plasticity we're talking about could go into rehabilitation if the person was young enough and could be rehabilitated through their teen years. They should at least be considered as a potential for parole under some very, very, very careful circumstances, obviously. But we know this same the impressionability of a teenager, their risk-taking, their ability, their overweighing the emotional content of something over the rational content can get them to be under the influence. We see this with ISIS, going – that's what they're going for, the teenagers, right? Because they know that they're vulnerable. They respond to the excitement, to the novelty, to the risk, and they don't think through it, they don't put one A and B together. So there's a lot of folks in the legal justice, in the justice system that are thinking about this. I think it has to be individual. And again, when we get better at understanding metrics of how to measure where a brain is, we might really all come to the conclusion that nothing magical happens at 12:01 a.m. on the first day of your 18th year of life, right?
Right.
There is not a demarcation like that. It is ridiculous to think that. But that's what we have to go with right now.
So when an adult says to a young person, a teenager, what were you thinking? Were they not thinking?
Well, I think that's, yes. I don't think they're thinking like we think.
Right.
And this is where, you know, again, this is the emotional, the over-emotional content. Because remember I said that the emotional areas of the brain actually connect up ahead of the frontal lobes. And actually, interestingly, they respond to stress and emotions more strongly. That's been seen in functional imaging. Again, when they're looking at brain images of people being shown pictures that are high emotional content. Interestingly, the teenage brain has a much bigger response than a child or an adult. So they're like hyped up, and they don't have the frontal lobes to say, no, this, you know, we got to calm down here. This can't be this bad. And so whenever I sort of talking to adults, I think, well, you know, you're an adult around these kids as a teacher or a parent or a colleague or an uncle or relative. You have to give them a frontal lobe assist because you do have your frontal lobes, and you have to sort of help them reason through explicitly. They are good learners.
Right.
So, you know, reason would have it that some of these things could get taught. And interestingly, on your interview earlier this morning on jobs for teenagers and like what they need to be taught, you know, they have to be taught explicitly job behavior. You know, things might not just come obviously to them, right?
Well, and taught in with patience, right? I mean,
that's
I think because
it's not
tall,
like an adult.
They might be taller than we are, so we think they are perhaps more mature or more adult than they actually are if they're, let's say, 16 mm-hmm. years old.
That's right.
We have an email. He says, "What your guest is describing explains why the military puts so much energy into recruiting 18-year-olds. Do you agree with that?" I actually thought of that as well.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. So let's just think about the mixed messages society gives this window of life. Right? They give the 18 to 21-year-old set: you can go to war for us. You can't drink alcohol. You can drive, but with significant restrictions. You can't rent a car, but you can vote. You know, and it just goes on and on. And we have so much ambivalence, and I think we sort of imagine teenagers are more adult in some areas and then less adult in others. So we withdraw their privileges in those latter areas, but may afford them those privileges in. So it has been noted that, you know, teenagers are more impulsive, and that may be an advantage. You know, in the military, these are the people on the front lines, and it's a scary thought.
Sure, it is. Well, a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, our guest is Frances Jensen, and she is the author, co-author of a new book called The Teenage Brain. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. And if you're just joining us, we are talking about the teenage brain. And that happens to be the title of our guest, Frances Jensen's new book. And it's subtitled A Neurologist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We were talking right before the break about the military, the fact that the military recruits young people. We were talking during the break about a traumatic brain injury. This is the sort of signature injury of these wars that we are involved in Iraq and Afghanistan. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So it is the signature injury because, of course, the body armor has become so sophisticated, and they do have helmets, but they're surviving injuries because of the body armor. And the leftover problem is that their head is heavily injured, and they end up with long-term brain injury. Interestingly, some of these impact injuries of the explosions that can happen, where it's just a pressure wave that goes across the air and hits the head, it doesn't even have to be a physical object, jostles the brain inside and has it, you know, bang into the inside of your skull, and that causes just a huge amount of damage, obviously. And what we're learning is that, you know, these brains, these young people, these people under 25 have brains that aren't mature yet, and they are actually suffering more brain injury in military combat than older adults who would be getting the same kind of injury. So it's sort of doubly tragic, actually.
Indeed. We have a tweet from Kelly. She wants to know about chronic stress, i.e. academic chronic stress on the teenage brain. Is there an effect?
Well, remember I said that the teen brain is very impressionable to good and bad things, and actually it will build itself according to what it sees, right? So it can build itself very, very well, or it can go off into a bad area of, you know, and not develop as normally and leave you with long-term problems. Stress is one of those things, actually. It's been shown that stress during in animals and in humans, stress during adolescence can increase your risk of depression later in life. And just like learning can affect the brain and affect the chemistry and help you build pathways, so can stress. It's just not building a good pathway, and it's causing neurochemical differences that will increase your risk of depression, of the known mechanisms of depression later in life.
Thinking about high crime neighborhoods, for instance, where there is stress, there's the sound of gunfire, there's the, you know, the worry that, will I be safe walking to school? Does that have an effect on a teenage brain?
That is a form of stress, yes. And also sleep deprivation, of course, that can go along with that. But all of these things also affect in-the-moment learning. So interestingly, stress affects this process of synaptic plasticity we were talking about earlier, where you're building synapses, where your brain cells connect and talk to each other with, you know, through experience. When you learn a fact, you're making that synapse that subserves memorizing that fact stronger, and that's called a memory. So that process, the building blocks to building that synapse, actually can be very much down-regulated by stress and cortisol and all the other stress hormones that go along with it. So that can actually affect how they function in school the next day.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like Devin from Quakertown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Devin. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
All right. Hello. I was just calling to ask. I'm 19, and I've been through two different substance addictions already, and I was wondering if that impacts me more than, say, like a 25-year-old or 24-year-old. He said how our brain's growing from back to front and all that.
And Devin, what kind of addictions are we talking about?
What?
What kind of addictions are we talking about?
Well, opiate's the first one, and then alcohol for the second.
And how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I mean, I've gotten better. I know how to control myself now and all that good jazz.
Well, first of all, I would like to tell you, you should feel very proud of yourself for having gone to the intervention programs. And I wish you all every wish to that you will stay well, having been to this second one. It is not uncommon that when you get addicted to one thing, your brain finds it easier to get addicted to another thing. That's something you need to know about. And you also need to know that it's because you were younger, it was more easy for you to get addicted. But the fact that you've been to an intervention center and you still have a brain that can change, you are probably going to get more out of that intervention than an adult, you know, who's 30 years older than you. If you really attend to it and you really follow what they say, you're going to pick up the skills much better, and they'll be more long-lasting too. So I hope that helps you.
Indeed. Devin, thanks for the call, and good luck to you as well. We've got Kevin from Wilmington joining us. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you, Marty, and thank you, Dr. Jensen, for
your
work.
Sure.
I'm a very proud uncle on the way home from my nephew's 8th grade graduation, and I am wondering about the impact of nutrition, either positively to progress the development of the brain in the adolescent or negatively to impact it.
It's a good question, Kevin. Go ahead.
Yeah. Actually, nutrition is very, very important. And the main thing, the main story with nutrition is a steady, kind of steady as she goes, balanced nutrition. To try to avoid, you know, massive sugar highs, long periods of low sugar or dehydration, living off of foods that are predominantly additives, to try to keep a more natural, balanced, the real old-fashioned square meal is exactly what a teenager needs. And of course, you know, checking with your pediatrician around whether they need vitamin supplementation based on the diet that you're describing. But absolutely, again, you know, your brain does not like to be dehydrated. Your brain does not like to have low sugar or high sugar. It probably doesn't like a lot of artificial sweeteners. We know that actually you can have more migraines with a lot of additives, can actually increase your risk of migraines. So absolutely, it's great to start the kid off knowing what a good diet is. And actually, just to get back to this nature-nurture thing, it's a great time to learn, you know, good diet hygiene, if you will, really becoming aware of what a good healthy diet is. And I think you imprint in this window on that. Kids who are like eating a lot of junk food will probably eat a junk food through their adult life. But if you tell them and show them that there's alternatives, hopefully they'll remain with those, a healthier diet lifelong.
Kevin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. How about sleep? And I think teenagers are notorious either not sleepers or sleeping all day on a Saturday or Sunday. I mean, they have very kind of topsy-turvy sleep schedules.
Yeah, topsy-turvy is exactly what it looks like to everybody else. But there's biology behind that, and nature has a plan. And in fact, all mammals actually do this. The circadian rhythm of a teenager is the clock is set a couple of hours later, at least, than the adult. So when the adult is trying to go to sleep, it's usually around 9 or 9:30. And the reason that happens is you release something called melatonin, which is the same thing that you take over the counter when you're trying to cure jet lag, right? So your brain puts that out. It starts to make you sleepy. You're asleep by 10, 11 o'clock at night. The teenager's brain is programmed to put that out around just before midnight. So they're not going to sleep till after. So they really have a biological reason to be doing that. And then the worst part is that they don't get their 9 hours of sleep because we wake them up at 6 o'clock to get on a bus, you know, to get ready for school. So they're living potentially chronically sleep deprived. And when they arrive at school, it's like, you know, 6 a.m. for 7 a.m. for a teenager is like 4 a.m. for an adult. You're not going to be doing your best work under those circumstances. So it begs the question as to whether school curricula need to be, you know, modified a little bit so that the more arduous, more brain intense work might be done more later in the morning, for instance.
I did want to ask you about mental illness, and it seems to appear that if someone develops schizophrenia or some form of mental illness, tends to happen in the sort of late adolescence, very early adulthood. Is there something about what is happening to the brain at that part at that time that could explain it?
Absolutely, and that was one of the things that another fascinating fact is it's not, you know, that this the high incidence of depression and suicide attempts and things that colleges will talk about and we see, it's not because, you know, the main reason is not just because they entered a new environment. Actually, the brain has reached a point in maturity where schizophrenia and bipolar illness, which actually have to involve the prefrontal and frontal lobes to actually manifest themselves. So if you don't have them hooked up, you won't really be showing the disease. But once your brain naturally starts to hook up these other regions, prefrontal and frontal cortex, your brain can now, you know, kind of do schizophrenia and
really?
Do bipolar illness.
Really?
And you might have had the genes for it all the way along, but as a child, since you weren't really accessing that part of your brain in that way, it wasn't manifested. It wasn't obvious. So we see it come on, and there's a real biological reason to why this is coming on. Now, a couple of things about that. It's happening at a time where you're still a risk taker. So, you know, suicidality is an impulsive thing. So that is also playing into it. Plus, your peers may not be the world's most empathetic group at that point because they too are not fully, you know, evolved. And so you may not be getting the support around you. So again, I think parents, college counselors, teachers that begin to see signs of a person becoming, disinterested, apathetic, moody to an extreme need to at least just probe a little bit further to make sure that this is not one of those cases.
Let me get Karen from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
You know, I'm wondering if it's correct to make an analogy between your brain and your bones, and that you're building your bones in your young adulthood, and then it kind of falls off, and that's when you have to really get strong, good bones. I'm wondering if the brain works the same way in that golden teenage time.
Well, let's find out. Go ahead.
Well, yes. I mean, your brain is the last organ in your body to mature. It doesn't finish its job until the mid to late 20s. So absolutely, you are building the scaffolding of what you're going to work with for the rest of your life. Your brain, you only get a few extra neurons, a few extra brain cells in adulthood. Mostly your brain cell number is dropping through adolescence into adulthood. So you really you got to build, customize your brain for your life at this point. Of course, you can learn later. I hope we're all learning. But it's harder to learn as an adult. It's just a time. It's sort of like carpe diem. It's like seize the moment in this window because it's so much easier to do the groundwork then than later.
Karen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. It seems this generation of teenagers, you know, have grown up with computers and cell phones and texting and, you know, all the stuff that we love and hate at the same time. You talk about the digital invasion of the teenage brain. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? How should we understand this?
Well, so start with, you know, this is going to be their lives. This is not going away. This is only going to get more. And for the generation that is now being born, it's going to be, you know, just unimaginable, the amount of connectivity that we have and the amount of information simultaneously streaming into our poor little brains. So teenagers, because they can learn better, and children too, they're growing up in this environment. So to some extent, we believe, and there are some studies to suggest this, that they are better at multitasking than adults, but they're not perfect. And I point out in a couple of the studies in the book where they tested teenagers when they had them distracted when they were learning a task, and they were able to show that even these today's teenagers still learned better when they could focus and they had undivided attention. They are better with divided attention, but they're not perfect. The brain does want focus for it to work at its most optimum.
And that's Frances Jensen, our guest on Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. But picking up on that, as you say, the teenage brain loves novelty. And you think of, you know, your cell phone goes off. I mean, I experienced this myself. I'm no teenager, and I'm like a rat in a maze. You know, I want to know. It's like it's some kind of reinforcement that's going on.
I'm fidgeting right now because I know my smartphone is in my handbag and it's turned off
it's
in the other room, and I just can't imagine
you.
The 42 emails that have right. arrived since. So yeah, I think we all are novelty seeking to an extent, but teenagers can go overboard because they don't actually know how to regulate right. themselves. I mean, it's just not yet a skill set they have. So they're a vulnerable group to the perils of social networking and overload on the internet. They can take risks psychologically, for instance, on the internet that they probably an adult would choose not to take. And I think, you know, the whole thing with cyberbullying and the fact that, you know, schoolyard pranks of yesteryear, little nasty things that people do to each other when they're not thinking as they're growing up, could be, you know, a small thing, a bad note, a picture on a bulletin board. But now there are images that go viral worldwide and can cause ruin somebody's life. And I think that they are maybe not fully aware that they're playing with as much fire as they are. But I believe that schools are delving into this more now and that they really are trying to teach good sort of internet hygiene and social networking hygiene. I think every teenager has had some minor, bad, embarrassing event. It's almost a certainty that they will learn from a mistake. But sometimes the mistakes can be really bad, and we'd like to make people aware before they make
sure,
those.
Indeed. Your book ends with a postscript and some advice to parents or, I guess, adults that live with or deal with teenagers. Be tolerant of your teenager's misadventures. Don't be shocked when your teen does something stupid. I mean, just be calm.
Yeah.
Caring, I guess.
Right. I do think that I did turn what could have been anger and frustration into curiosity when I started to research and put together the talks and then ultimately the book. And I think it did help me be a better parent. It also helps me understand young people in my laboratory that I work with or patients that I see in this window. I think you can count to 10. You can realize that you do have a frontal lobe. They don't. And you can really try to work your way through it. It helps you be more patient. And it also helps you not alienate them, which I think is really important.
Well, I'd like to end on that note, and my thanks to you for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, our guest has been Frances Jensen, and she's a professor chair of the neurology department at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia, and again, co-author of this book written with Amy Ellis Nutt, and it's called The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. Claire Moran, our intern this summer. Kevin Griffin, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.